You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our own Stephanie Elkins joins the show for a look at two African-American women composers whose compositions are getting a new look a century later. We'll hear their stories and some of their music. Now it's time for our weekly review of state news. We check in with a few different reporters about the stories they've been covering around Wisconsin. First, an estimated 4,000 people traveled to the state capitol on Wednesday for the annual Day Without Immigrants, a yearly event meant to highlight the economic impact of immigrants and issues affecting the Latino and Hispanic communities. Phoebe Petrovic was there. She's Wisconsin Public Radio's Lee Ester News Fellow. Phoebe, thanks a lot for being here.
Good to be here.
Well, this event has become a yearly thing around the country. What were some of the issues that this year's demonstration at the state capitol focused on?
So specifically in Wisconsin, the activists were fighting for two main things. That's allowing undocumented immigrants to get driver's licenses and state-issued ID cards, and then also allowing them, if they attended a Wisconsin high school and lived in the state for 3 years, to be qualified for in-state tuition.
And one of the speakers was Christine Newman Ortiz, head of the group Voces de la Frontera. Here's a listen.
Con nuestros sacrificios pasados no han sido en vanos y no serán hoy. Our sacrifices in the past has not been in vain, and they will not be in vain today.
So, Phoebe, can you give us a sense of the range of speakers at that event?
Sure. So we heard from leaders in this fight and activists like Christine Newman Ortiz, but then we also heard from small business owners, high school students who are trying to go to college, a co-owner of a dairy farm who many of his workers are undocumented immigrants, teachers, and then also the Madison's new mayor, Satya Rhodes Conway, and Chief of Police Mike Koval. Both of them said that they support undocumented immigrants having driver's licenses.
In a nutshell, what were some of the arguments you heard from speakers and others about why they support this idea of providing licenses or IDs to people living in Wisconsin and in the country without documentation?
So the main thing is safety. So when you get a driver's license, you have to pass a roads test and a skill test. And then, so if you have to, if everyone can get a driver's license, they have to pass those things. So everyone says that, you know, we have people on the road, so we know, have those requisite skills, and it makes everyone safer.
And is there any political action on this issue in the Capitol?
So this week, the chairs of the Joint Finance Committee said that they are going to repeal all of the non-fiscal parts of Governor Evers' budget proposal, and that includes those things. So it likely will not pass in this budget. It could be introduced as alternative legislation.
Phoebe, thanks a lot for sharing the story with us.
Thank you.
Phoebe Petrovic is WPR's Lee Ester News Fellow. She was with us to talk about this week's demonstration at the Capitol on the annual Day Without Immigrants. Now, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources decided not to reissue a permit for a Georgia frac sand company to fill in 16 acres of wetlands in Monroe County. It's the latest move in the permitting process that's played out over the last 2 years. Chris Hubbock is a reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal covering energy and transportation. Chris, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, tell us about this wetland site and what Meteor Timber was hoping to do with it.
So Meteor wants to build a processing and rail loading facility that would serve a couple of frac sand mines. This is on land that they purchased as part of about 50,000-acre acquisition back in 2014, and they discovered that they had silica sand reserves in Monroe County, but need a place to process it, wash it, and get it onto a rail line. But the site that they settled on would require filling about 16.25 acres of wetlands.
So there's been this long court battle over whether they're allowed to do that and over the DNR's previous approval process. What is this new decision now from the DNR from a different administration?
So so the DNR granted them a permit to fill the wetlands. A couple of groups, the Ho-Chunk Nation, which is based nearby, and the Clean Wisconsin, challenged that permit. This was in 2017. There was a hearing, about a week-long hearing in front of an administrative law judge about a year ago. That administrative law judge determined that the DNR did not have enough information to meet the legal requirements to issue that permit, and so he revoked the permit. Meteor then appealed that to Secretary Dan Meyer, who was head of the DNR under the previous Scott Walker administration. The DNR spent about a year reviewing that, and then this week, Secretary Preston Cole, appointed by Tony Evers, closed the close the review without taking any action. So he didn't affirm or overturn the judge's decision. He just let it stand.
So the judge's decision stands, at least for now. No permit, but as I understand it, the story's still ongoing in the courts, right?
Right. Meteor also, around the same time that they appealed to DNR, they also appealed it in the courts. A Monroe County judge, they'll kind of put that case on hold until the DNR made some decision. So that case is sitting out there, and presumably if Meteor decides they still want to pursue this, they'll ask the judge to reopen that case.
And what has Meteor's case been for why they feel they should be able to fill in the wetlands?
They say they've met all the requirements of the law. In fact, they say they've gone above and beyond, that they offered to restore some other wetlands nearby and preserve, I think, about 640 acres of land that they own elsewhere, which is more than the typical compensation that was required by the law, quite a bit more.
We'll keep watching this as it goes through the courts. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Chris Hubbock covers energy and transportation at the Wisconsin State Journal. He talked to us about the DNR's decision not to reissue a permit to fill in wetlands as part of a frac sand mining project in Monroe County. Finally, a new report from a national industry group shows that Wisconsin's forestry business leads the Midwest. Rob Mentzer is WPR's Rural Communities reporter, and he recently wrote about this. Rob, welcome back.
Why, thank you.
Now, how is Wisconsin's forestry business doing compared to nationwide?
So the Wisconsin's forestry industry has grown in basically every metric that this report studied, timberland acres and value of the wood and number of jobs. They're actually Wisconsin leads the Midwest. Actually, the South has a whole lot of forestry jobs, a big industry in the South, and Wisconsin is not the leading state in the nation, but definitely leads the Midwest by quite a bit in most of these metrics.
Now, a story we've followed in the state over the years, and you've been based in the Wausau area, is a big story there, the decline of the paper industry. And you might think this would be a problem for the forestry business. I think it was in the past. What is balancing that out?
Yeah, I found this to be a little bit of a twist to this. So the paper mill closures have in fact meant some decline in the amount of pulp wood that comes out of Wisconsin forests. That's my sources confirm. But what's offset it is that Wisconsin is getting more of the very high quality wood that goes into like hardwood flooring or furniture or other more like premium products. And that is because as some of the state's forests are getting older, loggers are able to harvest more of this saw timber, and that is much more valuable wood, and so that has more than offset the small decline in pulpwood.
And based on what you heard from people in the industry, it sounds like people doing this forestry business, they're looking in the long term now.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this report is from the National Alliance of Forest Owners. That's sort of a lobbying group or an advocacy group. But the point that they make is that if forestry works as a business, then those landowners want to preserve it as forest, as opposed to growing crops or selling it for vacation homes or whatever. And in order to do that, they're making investments that are, you're talking about 20, 30 years or more.
And finally, as we wrap up, Rob, just briefly talk about the number of jobs, if you have that in front of you, more than I actually would have thought.
Yeah, the jobs in Wisconsin. So this is direct and indirect jobs because there are sort of support jobs and it supports other things. But they said almost 175,000 jobs in the state of Wisconsin supported by the logging industry, a big industry.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Hey, thanks.
That's Rob Mentzer, WPR's Rural Communities reporter. He talked with us about the state's forest industries and wrapped up our weekly look at news stories from around Wisconsin. Female classical composers are not often well known, and African-American composers can suffer from the same lack of attention. There's been renewed interest lately, though, in the lives and works of two African-American women composers based in Chicago in the early 20th century. Stephanie Elkins is the host and programmer of Morning Classics on WPR's News and Classical Music Network. She looked into the lives and careers of Margaret Bonds and Florence Price. Stephanie, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks, Rob. Great to be back.
Now, before we get to these two composers and their works, these are African-American women working at a time when neither African-Americans nor women, I imagine, would be accepted into the world of classical music. Can you talk about the reception they got?
That's right. Well, it was in Chicago when they were really flourishing, and there was kind of a progressive movement happening then, so there was a window of opportunity, but really, they were rare. They were going to college and studying classical music at a time where that was an aberration. They were both, you know, African-American women at the University of Chicago, at Northwestern, at the New England Conservatory, at a time when that was not very common at all. In fact, one of them even lied and said she was Mexican to be able to get in and get started.
Now, let's look at each of them and their careers in turn. Starting with Florence Price, can you tell us about her early years and how she came into music?
She was born in Arkansas in 1880. And her mom was a music teacher, so she got a nice early start. And it sounds like she was already composing on her own by the time she was 11 years old. So she was already primed. And she must have been pretty smart because she was already she was the one who said she was Mexican to get into the New England Conservatory. And so she was there by the time she was 16. She was studying with some of the great composers, George Chadwick, and they accepted her, and she did really well in school. And she just kept on going. She was really curious and avid and studied a lot.
Talk about her body of work. What kind of things was she doing in her compositions?
Well, you know, it was interesting at that time. Women were expected to maybe study piano, and so they could play in the living room when guests would come over and that kind of thing. And if they were composing, they would compose these little salon pieces. But Florence Price created these big orchestral works. She did these symphonies and piano concertos and really rich, huge pieces. And she also created some beautiful piano pieces that were based on African-American spirituals and some jazz and some blues. You hear sort of pentatonic stuff in her music. It's really an amazing synthesis of sounds.
Now, later we're going to go out with one of her symphonies. Right now I want to listen to her piece, Dances in the Canebrakes. Here's a listen. As we listen, Stephanie, what stands out to you in this work?
This was one of her late pieces. She wrote it just before she died. It was 1953. And she named this, Dances in the Canebrakes. This is sugar cane from the plantation. So you're already sort of getting this feel of, you know, slavery and the plantations. And then the three movements are called Nimble Feet. And that kind of brings the cakewalk to mind. And then Tropical Noon is kind of languid and summery. And she does a lot of what we call text painting, where she brings these words to life through the music. And then the last one is Silk Hat and Walking Cane. And that's kind of like a slow rag. And you can almost see a sharp-dressed guy, like maybe doing a soft shoe or something like that. It's very evocative.
And for Florence Price and for Margaret Bonds, actually, both of them, their music was definitely informed, it looks like, by African-American history in the United States and the African-American present at the time they were composing.
Absolutely. They had both been influenced by, well, they were both brought up in the church, so they were influenced by church music that they were hearing in African-American churches, and they were both influenced by spirituals and by Langston Hughes. They both worked with Langston Hughes and that poetry, that very empowering poetry that he wrote. And so they were evoking that in their music and incorporating that in their music.
Talking to Stephanie Elkins from WPR, looking at the lives and careers of Margaret Bonds and Florence Price, two American composers, both African-American women, early in the 20th century. Let's move on now, Stephanie, to Margaret Bonds. They overlapped in terms of years. They also intersected in their careers. We can talk about that, but give us some of the story of Margaret Bonds.
Margaret Bonds was younger than Florence Price, almost a generation. She was born 26 years after, and she was friends Florence Price was friends with the parents of Margaret Bonds first, and then she became Margaret Bonds's teacher. She was a composition teacher. Margaret Bonds was a kind of a child prodigy. She was another one that started composing right away. And so she was born in Chicago, 1913, and she became well-educated like Price. She got her master's degree at Northwestern, her bachelor's degree, both in music. And she was already sort of precocious, and so Florence Price, rather, took her under her wing and really helped her start composing. And she flourished under Florence Price's mentorship.
And what kind of things was she composing? How would you describe her music?
Well, she was a generation after Florence Price, so she was a little more modern. And she left and went to New York City. She studied at Juilliard after she got her master's. And she was in this whole post-Harlem Renaissance flourishing in the city. And she's the one that really connected with Langston Hughes first. And so she has more of modern jazz sounds in her music, and she was using more blues in her music. So she really incorporated a lot of the more modern sensibilities that African Americans were using in their music in New York City.
Well, I want to listen and get a taste of what you're talking about, actually, to the music of Margaret Bonds. Here is a piece called Troubled Waters. Melody there, Stephanie, but with a twist. Talk about that.
Right. This is Wade in the Water. It's such a powerful spiritual, and it's one that's been familiar from the early days of slavery. It was used to kind of give hope to slaves, to say, you know, if you're being chased, you can go in the water and escape your pursuers. And she took this and she made such a powerful piano fantasy from it, and you can tell from her piece that it's real. She must have been a super pianist herself to be able to write something like this. She put it full of feeling. I mean, it is just packed with lots of evocative feeling. Throughout, though, you hear the melody. You hear that you can almost sing along with that at the beginning, but she develops it and develops it. You can hear the craft. I mean, it's just beautifully crafted as a composition.
And it starts off with a darker minor key. I guess the original is kind of in a minor key, but it feels more minor to me as I hear it.
Exactly. You've got that sort of pentatonic modal feel to it that you hear in some of the African-American spirituals.
Now, looking at both of them now, Margaret Bonds and Florence Price, how widely known were they in their own time?
They were known in a local basis. In Chicago, they were sort of minorly known. That's not an adverb, but I'm going to use it there. Florence Price won a composition contest in Chicago in the early 1930s, and her symphony was performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. This was unheard of, this African-American woman, and the symphony played it, and she got instant celebrity from that. And then the next year, her piano concerto was performed, and she got Margaret Bonds to be the soloist for that. So the two of them kind of helped each other, and through that, they had this sort of minor celebrity in Chicago. And there were some progressive people in Chicago at the time who were very encouraging for them and helping them to have these opportunities.
Now, you have introduced me to this music, Stephanie. I'll admit I hadn't heard these before. I want to hear more now. Are people out nowadays, or in recent decades even, making new recordings of their compositions.
Yes, it's an amazing story. I want to say 9-10 years ago, there was a house going to be demolished outside of Chicago. The renovators found this treasure trove of handwritten music. They didn't know. They figured out it was by Florence Price. They found out that she had graduated or had grown up in Arkansas. They've contacted the University of Arkansas, where some of her work is. And so through that, that music was then published. The musicians that were involved in this project did a Kickstarter, and they had made a recording of a couple of her violin concertos, and that was just released last year. So, yes, it's finally coming out. But it was literally, if those people had chucked it in the dumpster, I mean, we'd never know that she had written this amazing music.
What a thin thread. Wow. So is this being archived now a little more properly than in a trunk in a room in a house that's being demolished?
Yeah, there's now a whole center for Florence Price's music at the University of Arkansas, and scholars can come there and study her music. And there are more and more scholars studying Margaret Bonds' music, and they're looking at that whole world that was really flourishing in Chicago in the 1930s, 1920s and 30s.
Well, are Margaret and Florence finding their way onto your own playlists,
Stephanie? Oh, you bet. In fact, just this morning, it wasn't planned, but I, you know, we were going to talk, and I had already scheduled it weeks ago. I had a piece by Florence Price on the playlist called The Negro Fantasy that she wrote and dedicated to Margaret Bonds.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Stephanie, thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for asking.
Stephanie Elkins is the host and programmer of Morning Classics on WPR's News and Classical Music Network. She is with us to share the stories of two African-American women composers from the early 20th century. Here is some of Florence Price's Violin Concerto No. 1. We'll let that take us into the news. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's been a big week in news at Facebook. The company announced the rollout of a wholesale redesign of the site on all of its platforms, and the company has reportedly told the Federal Trade Commission that it's opened a new federal oversight of its privacy practices. That and, as of yesterday, a number of controversial figures like Alex Jones and Louis Farrakhan have been banned from all of the company's platforms. Steve Knoll is a professor of marketing at Madison College. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Great. Thanks for having me back.
Well, there kept being more stuff to talk about related to Facebook. Let's start with, I use the phrase Facebook and its platforms.
Right.
When Facebook does something, it's not necessarily just that. They own other social media things that people are out there using.
Correct. Yeah. The three big ones, it's Facebook, obviously, is the big one. But Instagram is also owned by Facebook. And then Messenger. A lot of people just use Messenger as a standalone app to communicate with people. All three of them are part of the Facebook ecosystem. In fact, there's talk about merging all three into one product, but that just seems kind of contrary to the strengths and weaknesses to the products.
Now, let's start with this redesign. Now, this is something that affects, you know, a billion plus users at this
2.4 billion monthly users.
Yeah, so there you go. Lots of people are going to see this change.
Yes.
What is the change?
So what they're doing is they've already started rolling it out on the phone apps. It's a less of an emphasis on the timeline streaming and more about groups and events. So the idea behind it is, there's a lot of people, they go on Facebook and they end up seeing stuff that, you know, it makes them angry, makes them stressed out and all that. And if you start a group and put yourself into a group, you have better control over the other people in it. And you have more of a shared commonality. And that's what they're looking for, is by focusing more on a group, they're hoping that there'll be less conflict amongst people in the group, and also giving you easier ways to maybe meet people who are also part of the group that you don't know in the real world.
And part of the deal with groups is if I want to start a group, mm-hmm. I can make it as open to the public or as closed,
right.
and I have to
yep.
approve every single person as
Correct.
I want to. This idea, it's like a walled garden mm-hmm. within Facebook, and it's really different than what they've done in the past, right?
Sure, yeah. They've always been much more, you know, as open as possible. The more open, the better. And that kind of plays into the whole, the more open you are, the more information they can mine from you to, you know, put an ad in front of you. But with groups, yeah, you've always been able to kind of control the level of privacy. And I've been using groups for years for a variety of different functions, family stuff and events and other projects that I've worked on. You put everyone in a group and then you can make it private. And then everyone can share information using Facebook, but only the people in the group see it. So it's been a nice utility. But that's now going to become the main focus of Facebook. It'll be interesting to see how people adapt from this open world concept to more silos.
You were starting to touch on this, I think, but what problems does Facebook see this as fixing for users and I guess probably ultimately for Facebook in
right.
the long run?
Well, and part of it is this whole fake news phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And you have to remember, when we say fake news, there's a big difference between opinion news and actual real fake news. And a lot of people use the term fake news and they really mean opinion news. But there are industries out there. There are countries, Macedonia, for example, has a whole export system of generating fake news content and, you know, making tens of
big
thousands
money
of dollars.
Like that is the local economy.
That is the local
economy.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating story when you look at how this tiny little country has become like this, you know, factory of fake news. So a lot of that is delivered through the timeline system. And a lot of people, of course, were seeing this stuff, thinking it was real, getting all angry about it, sharing it to all their friends, not even realizing that they've been tricked for a variety of reasons. Some of them are malicious. Some of them are pranksters, whatever. They're still, you know, sharing stuff that they shouldn't be doing. So the move is to then try to get that, you know, out of the main view. When you log on to Facebook, you will be seeing, I don't want to say vetted, it's not really vetted information, but it's information from a more of a contained group that you know what the group is and what the nature of the group is. And so if you see something in that group that's completely out of character to the topic of that group, it'll allow you to say, hey, this shouldn't be here, or at least hopefully realize, hey, why is this here? And then suspect it a little bit, do a little digging, and then realize, oh, this is, you know, a bot or something, you know, that's just malicious. That's never going to stop. We are never going to get away from people doing this. They're just trying to minimize it versus eliminating it. They can't eliminate it.
Steve Knoll is with us from Madison College talking about a bunch of news related to Facebook, including this big change. It's already starting to phase in, going away from the infinite timeline that you scroll down forever to more of a groups focused effort. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? We heard from some of you earlier this week that you love the groups. You're starting your own. Love to hear from you about that. And if you find the current model of Facebook, the timeline where people show up and argue with you, frustrating or annoying, or you want it to stay, call now at 800-642-1234. Segueing into some of the other news, Steve, Facebook will still be able to take this stuff we do and figure out a way, I'm guessing, to make money off of it.
Oh, they have to. I mean, that's their core business model is, you know, you are the product. That's the old marketing saying. If something's free, you're the product. And nobody is going to pay, you know, $5 a month for Facebook. People have been made that very, very clear. So the business model behind Facebook is not going to change. But the big question is, you know, they say that there's more of a impact on being more private and secure, but that runs counter to this get as much information about you so we can put relevant advertisers in front of you business model that they need to survive. So that's the big long-term, how is this going to work, is right now groups are pretty contained, but as it rolls out, are groups going to be more saturated with advertising? Will the advertising be directed to individuals in the group, or will the advertising be directed at the topic of the group? You know, these are questions that we're still kind of waiting. The rollout just started. Some people aren't even seeing it yet. Mm-hmm. It's starting out on phone apps. It hasn't even made it to desktop apps, but of course most people.
So I haven't seen it yet.
Yes, yeah.
Most people. Sorry,
yeah.
Steve.
Well, it's okay. That's okay. Most people haven't, you know, they still use the phone apps.
Sure.
And even then, depending on what version you're on, it's a gradual rollout. But probably the next few weeks, it'll get around to everybody having it.
Now, we mentioned the number of billions of Facebook users.
2.4 billion.
There's also billions in the news. A fine may be on the way for Facebook, based in part, as I understand it, on how Facebook has used our data and who they've shared it with in the past. What's going on?
Correct. So part of this is the Wild West. Technology travels very fast, and the law tends to lag behind. So we're in kind of a gray area here where there has been talk about, you know, the government coming in and leveraging, you know, consumer fines against Facebook for not protecting people's data. You know, and a lot of people say, oh, Facebook sells your data to advertisers. That's actually not true. You have to understand Facebook is an ad broker. So an advertiser gives an ad to Facebook, and then Facebook takes that ad and puts it in front of a relevant user. They are not selling that user data to a business, according to the model. Now, of course, what has happened is through various things, some of that data has gotten out, you know, either through hacks or through, you know, of course, the infamous Cambridge Analytica scandal. And so the government is kind of stepping in and saying, you know, hey, maybe we really need to look at this and punish them with a fine. Europe has been doing this. You know, the EU is a couple years ahead of the U.S. in terms of, like, privacy laws. So a lot of what we're seeing in the U.S. is stuff that started to show up. And Facebook's already had, you know, hefty fines. So is Google. Google is actually much more aggressive with data mining than Facebook is. But, of course, Facebook is the famous one, so it gets all the press.
And part of the deal, there's reporting anyway that Facebook is talking to the Federal Trade Commission. One outcome might be not just this fine, but that there are going to be new privacy czars or something like that Facebook. This is not a done deal yet, I don't think, but what are we hearing about?
Well, that's kind of an interesting idea, because the whole idea of, you know, people regulating this stuff, Facebook should have been doing it right away. So they've kind of been caught in a catch-22. You know, they're saying we're now going to have people who their sole job is to be, you know, these, you know, strongholds of data. But yet they also say, but yet our systems are pretty secure. So I think what they're doing is telling the politicians what the politicians want to hear. But I think they're just trying to do what they've always been done, maybe just with a little better eye. I think that's Facebook's big problem, is that they've been a little naive. They really think that, you know, people will do the good. When you have a thing, people always do the right thing and the good thing, and that's not true. Welcome to humanity.
We'll watch how that comes out with the FTC. Let's bring out a caller now on Facebook groups. Scott is with us in Madison. Scott, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I love the groups. I'm in and created a number of them. We've got, you know, the extended family group for keeping track of, you know, events like Christmas and such. We've got a neighborhood group for setting up play dates for the kids. But my favorite is I'm in a international group for dads to connect. And it's got 14,000 members.
Wow. Yeah.
And so made a lot of friends through that, got a lot of advice and support, and shared a lot of advice and support with that. We've got subgroups of that, like Dads of Twins and Multiples, Do-It-Yourself Project Dads, Dads with Kids with Special Needs. And then we have local geographic groups, which are a subset of that. So we've got a Wisconsin group.
Scott, thanks a lot for bringing that up. That reminds me of the original Yahoo TV ads where it was showing, you know, the punk rocker whose friends made fun of him for knitting. Online he finds the knitting group. That's
sure. And
now, did Facebook create this really on purpose, or it seems like it was there and then the users made this thing happen?
Yeah, and that's the interesting is groups is really an old Facebook concept. When you talk about the early days of Facebook, everyone, even before they had pages, a lot of businesses started using groups as a business tool. And then Facebook created business pages, and then groups kind of started to fade away. And I think Facebook wanted groups to fade away, but the users found them and kind of resuscitated them and really made them those are really good examples of how the strength of social media is taking geography out of the equation. You can meet people with common interests all over the world. That's really the strength of social media with that. And, you know, they're talking about things like neighborhood groups. That's probably one of the biggest growing area in these groups is neighborhood groups. But of course, that brings up a whole different level of privacy because, you know, that neighbor on the other side of the block, or now they know what you're doing and all that. And is that creepy or not?
We're talking to Steve Knoll from Madison College about some big news from Facebook, a new look for their platform, some new federal privacy oversight maybe on the way, and we'll get into yesterday's move to block a number of controversial users they called dangerous. You can join in at 800-642-1234. This new look at Facebook, it's rolling in now. Have you seen the change on your phone yet? What do you think about it? If so, does the new focus on groups and events line up with the way you use or want to use Facebook? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Steve Knoll from Madison College about some of the big news coming out of Facebook this week, including a big change in their look, less focus on the timeline. It'll still be there. More focus on groups. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea, this change, this focus on groups? You do the groups on Facebook. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also share other Facebook-related questions and thoughts. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page along the way. Before we get into this big ban on some users of Facebook, I want to take another call. Steve, Dan is with us in Drummond. Dan, hi.
Hi. One of the things that I find frustrated is there's a website called Dogstar. And before you get to go to the story, it sends you to a page that's trying to sell things. And I just find that so frustrating. Story is great, but then, as I say, there's like some of the things, it says 7 incredible weight loss habits or impressive home remedies and treatment of appendicitis.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. So even if the content looks nice, it might take us through some weird stuff to get there.
Yeah, that's referred to as an interstitial ad, where they show you an ad before you get to the content.
Uh-huh.
And it is kind of frustrating. And advertisers have to kind of balance out, you know, how annoying they can be versus, you know, having to have the ads there in order to get to the to pay for the content.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Now, I want to touch on this, one of the more recent stories. Facebook unrolled a big ban on what they call dangerous users, Louis Farrakhan, Alex Jones, Milo Yiannopoulos, I think was one, Laura Loomer. What was their case? What was the case they made for removing them from the platform?
So part of it is Facebook has always had kind of an anti-hate speech policy. And a lot of these users have had temporary bans and also some bans on like Instagram versus Facebook. And yesterday they pretty much said these are going to be permanent. And I think it's a good move. I think all these people do have a reputation of you know, there's a big difference between free speech and hate speech. And there are people out there that want to purvey hate speech by packaging it as free speech. That's what these people are doing. It's really, these are groups, they are well-documented groups. And I think Facebook taking this step of permanent banning is a good thing that they probably should have done a long time ago. Twitter has also done similar bans. Facebook had banned some on Facebook, but not Instagram or the other way around. So there wasn't anything consistent. But the big news yesterday was these bans are permanent and it's across all the platforms. The big question on that, though, is who at Facebook is making the decisions? You know, the ones that they announced were people that had a pretty cut and dry case history. There wasn't a lot of ambiguity there. But going forward, who is making that judge? You know, who watches the watchers?
And the ACLU had raised concerns, kind of a slippery slope
it
argument.
Is.
Even if you say, okay, yes, maybe these are valid
sure.
cases, where do you draw the line? Do you decide that one part of a political perspective is good or bad? People are saying, well, what about if they start to ban Congress people if they
sure.
cross the line into hate speech?
So right. yep.
what kind of things, we can't read their minds, but what,
right.
do you, what kind of things would they be looking at?
Right.
There at Facebook?
Yeah, or if it's a one-time incident versus a pattern, I would think that it would be a pattern of stuff. And all the people that were banned yesterday had years and years of patterns. So I don't think there's any question about that group. The big question is going forward, what other groups or individuals could potentially, you know, be kicked off the biggest platform on earth?
And it's a big controversy on Twitter. I mean, a lot of people in their profile name, as their middle name, take, quote, ban the Nazis from Twitter
right,
or something
yeah.
like that. There
sure.
are concerns about lots of, and that tends to be more anonymous users, I think, with
Correct.
Various accounts.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Technically, on Facebook, you are supposed to use your real name, mm-hmm. and that's even a source of controversy.
Right.
And Facebook backed down on that policy a while ago. But Twitter, everything is handles, you know. I'm on Twitter. I teach marketing. It doesn't even have say Steve in it. So, you know, I could hide behind that if I wanted to. So it does give a little level of anonymity, which does tend to bring out the bad in a lot of people.
Now, what other kind of, I don't know if you've been watching the reactions on this story mm-hmm. since the bans, what kind of reactions are you seeing out there?
Well, it depends on your opinion of these people. Obviously, a lot of these people are more on the right-wing conservative side, and there has been a little bit of chatter about, you know, who's next. In fact, that was one of the statements. It just said, who's next? So certainly the mainstream right-wing media is kind of staying away from this story because I think they realize how volatile it is. Certainly people on the left are cheering it. You know, but again, it really comes down to, you know, your personal feelings on the left or right and how you feel about these people that got banned.
Talking to Steve Knoll from Madison College. He's a professor of marketing there, looking at some recent big news about Facebook, a new look there, some bans on what they say are dangerous promoters of hate speech, and possible privacy-related fines coming to Facebook. Okay, we're talking Facebook a lot. There are other social media outlets, but Facebook is the biggie.
It is the big one, yep,
by far. But do the decisions they make have a domino effect onto platforms, other platforms, even the ones they don't own?
Yeah. And you have to remember, Facebook is also Instagram and Messenger.
Right.
And that alone is pretty significant. But they will. I mean, they are the biggest player out there. I'm sure Google is watching what's going on, Snapchat, Twitter. They're all watching what's going on. You know, Twitter's been a little more aggressive in, you know, looking at this problem and attacking a little more head on. Snapchat really hasn't gotten too much into this because Snapchat's main demo is a lot younger people. You know, these are people that are not necessarily, quite honestly, voting a lot. And a lot of this controversy is they're trying to influence voting, and they're going to the areas where you can affect those people. And, you know, that demographic is just not seen on something like Snapchat. Eventually they will age up, and as they get older, you will leave Snapchat behind and go to Facebook. But people who use Snapchat don't want to hear that.
And in the way that people use other social media services, does there seem to be this gravitation toward, hey, I'm doing this stuff within some kind of group that I've selected to be in, as mm-hmm. opposed to I'm sending stuff out to the universe?
Correct. And that's the whole idea behind groups, is that people will feel a little more comfortable, that it is more of a, there's kind of rules. It's not just this unchained arena where all this crazy stuff is going on, that there's kind of like, I'm in a group about a specific topic. All the conversations will be about that topic. So, you know, obviously Game of Thrones, for example, there are many, many groups about Game of Thrones. And if you want to go in and just talk about that, you can do that. And, you know, if people are posting things about politics and all that aren't related to the Game of Thrones, they can get kicked out of the group. And, you know, these groups are moderated. They have moderators. You can report stuff. People can be kicked out. They can be banned. So there's a little more control of the content of the speech. And I think that's the hope, is that focusing a little more, you're not going to have all these different opinions coming from left field and hitting you on your timeline and freaking you out.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us. We'll leave it there for now.
Cool. Thank you.
That's Steve Knoll, marketing professor at Madison College. He was with us today to talk about Facebook's recent move to ban a handful of what they describe as dangerous users like Alex Jones and Louis Farrakhan. We also talked about new federal privacy oversight of the company and a big change, a new look for Facebook's platform. Less emphasis on that scrolling timeline, more emphasis on the groups that you decide to start or join along the way. You can share your thoughts on any of these issues, by the way. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up Monday on Central Time, a lot of local newspapers have closed down in recent years. A journalism expert tells us that that's creating news deserts, and that has bad results for communities and oversight of their local governments. Wisconsin's new DNR boss joins the show for a look at conservation efforts and how we pay for them around the state. And after the attacks on September 11, 2001, hundreds of airline passengers were stranded in Gander, Newfoundland. We'll meet a Wisconsinite who was there and take a look at a new musical about their experiences. All that and look at some of the latest news. It's coming up Monday here on Central Time.